can you give us one key lesson you've taken with you?
I would say, like, you know, the parable, but it taught me how to think about risk.
General contractor.
To go faster. I think everyone thinks as an entrepreneur, you're just trying to take on big risk, but actually I think it's the opposite. It's mitigating risk and de-risking.
Board member.
You're biting your tongue a lot. In fact, you're putting your hands in your pocket a lot because you kind of want to instinctively jump in and solve the problem.
What do you think is the number one skill someone needs as a CEO?
The number one skill. I think it's...
From a Harry Potter-like boarding school to skilled tradesman to visionary CEO and serial entrepreneur, today's guest is tackling the construction labor shortage with more than just a set of spells. I'm sorry. The US construction industry is facing a critical shortage of skilled labor, with over 90% of companies struggling to hire craft workers. Startups like Skillet are using technology to revolutionize how contractors recruit and manage their workforce. You're listening to Bricks and Bytes. And on this episode, we welcome Fraser Patterson, CEO and co-founder of Skillet. In this episode, we discuss how Fraser raised $13.5 million by crafting a compelling founder story, why 92% of construction workers now prefer a full-time job over a gig, the number one skill every startup CEO needs to master to succeed, and Fraser's unique ideal investor profile approach to fundraising. If you're enjoying our podcast, you can support us by heading over to www.bricksbytes.show and signing up to our newsletter. This is an easy and free way which helps us keep the podcast going. In addition, you'll receive all of the key insights from the guests we have on, as well as some bonus content about what's going on in the wider world of construction tech. And now, an announcement from our sponsor. BIM often feels overwhelming for contractors. That's why this episode is brought to you by Shift. They'll help you tackle all your digital needs from 3D BIM modeling to BIM strategy and beyond. Visit www.maketheshft.digital for more information. All right, Fraser. So you've been a co-founder in a bunch of startups. So to name a few, Bolster, Onus, and now Skillet. So you started as a carpenter. So can you tell us, like, that kind of journey, like, what were the major turning points that made you change your path from carpentry, which was very hands-on, and doing the stuff, to perhaps now more in a director, like the CEO position that you are in the tech world, and directing things?
I did start as a carpenter. But I think prior to that, I'd had a bit of an unusual, you know, education, in that I went to a boarding school where, in the north of Scotland, you referenced this Harry Potter-like school that I went to, and fell in love with math at an early age. So even though I went into carpentry following that, which I think that's the unusual part, everything else to me seems quite consistent. There's like a logical progression, but that was the kind of curveball, I think, was going from a, you know, boarding school to becoming a carpenter. But, you know, I really loved building. And I think there's so many parallels between building companies, building software, building, you know, buildings, the methodologies behind, you know, behind that, the kind of underlying operating system of how things get built well and how to do it well, I think are very similar. So, but yeah, I was a carpenter for many years in the GC. Like, that was the progression. So from, you know, kind of individual contributor, if you will, as a carpenter, and then to, you know, becoming the GC. I think as a carpenter, you touch on a lot of trades, so you tend to get a bit of an overview, right? More so than maybe other trades. So it's more natural you become the GC. And I also just had a bit of an entrepreneurial itch from, like, you know, my kind of early 20s when I was a carpenter. So I was kind of keen to get into the driving seat and actually, you know, build companies. And then from there, yeah, I think being a general contractor is, again, you got to have a, you want to have a good understanding of the fundamentals. And there's a lot of, you know, application of quant there. I got really into the kind of like financial risk side of it. Like, how do you minimize the risk for homeowners, and how do you, you know, optimize the efficiency, and how do you build great kind of like internal processes and continual improvement processes and stuff? So from there, you know, I got into essentially building startups. That was the kind of natural evolution. And so, I think it feels to me like quite a fairly straight path. It's just not many people start off as a car company and then end up, you know, building startups.
Mm-hmm. I think someone like Thomas Jefferson or someone said that people that have started from like a trade or something, I'm completely butchering the quote, by the way, but he's something, people that are like hands-on are actually more trustworthy or better for the world because they understand how things actually go together and how the world works. So you're following in the footpaths of Jefferson. It might not even been Jefferson. It was someone like...
Whoever it is, he said some great things, and that's a great thing to say. So, but yeah, I think there's truth to that, though. I mean, you certainly get to connect with the kind of atoms of the world, and you know, see the kind of the pain and the craft that goes into actually building things around us, and gain a kind of empathy for those that build things, and and an attachment to like a kind of interconnectivity, right? Like, it's easy to forget that like we're on a connection right now that without quality infrastructure couldn't happen. So it's you know, we're all part one and the same.
Great. I just wanted to touch on one more time on this on the past. And was there any turning point or exact point that you started thinking about software? Because like before you were not involved in the software, and like sudden like shift in mind that, okay, maybe I should look into building a startup within software space. Like, I'm just curious, how did this part evolve? What made you start thinking about software as a business?
Well, that's a good question. So I would say even while I was a GC, I was trying to figure out, are there, because I think there's a lot of misconceptions about what you do as a GC, right? It's a lot of administration, right? It's a lot of, you know, reliance on existing stacks of technology, all kind of like hodgepodge together. There's not really much of a kind of, you know, vertical stack just built for construction, for example, or there wasn't when I was a GC. So I was always trying to like figure out, how do you improve the processes? How do you make, you know, how do you make information flow faster and more reliably and across the kind of operation and across all the stakeholders, like giving clients complete visibility into their project, having like really tight financial controls and so on and so forth. So I think I was always kind of dabbling, if you will, in kind of software, and with a bit of a math background, I was kind of always drawn to that. And then I think it really comes down to the fact that if you're going to try and do something that's impactful and can actually move the needle on improving the industry that I love, then I think you have no choice but to get into building software or like, you know, tech enabled, you know, products or, so yeah, I think in Mexico, when I was the co-founder of Honest Vida, it's called, which is Honest Life, it translates into in English. That was essentially a network to de-risk renovation at scale, where, you know, architects and contractors could work with homeowners doing renovations, and both sides have complete transparency into both where the payments are at and where the progress on the project is. And we were the, you know, the kind of the software that connected that and made it possible. And so that was the first, I would say, true, you know, software enabled business. And then from there, yeah, that's become.
You escalate. I'm gonna hijack Martin's question, which is blended with a thesis about why the USA has a better environment for an entrepreneur versus Europe and the UK. Do you agree with that? And obviously you've been around, so what's your personal experience with that?
Yeah, I've been a founder in three countries now, obviously, like the UK, obviously London, and then Mexico, and now the US. I think So that's definitely true. I mean, it's certainly true from my experience, but like to zoom out and give you a kind of explanation as to why I think why. I think the US is a startup. I think that's one of the fundamental distinctions. You know, if you're in Europe, it's not an idea. Europe's not a concept, right? It's an historical kind of, you know, has an historical track record and norms and so on and so forth that just make it that little bit harder to get people to be voyeuristic and excited about why you change things, why things get changed. You know, the US has got this like a bit of a wide-eyed innocence and a bit of a kind of like voyeuristic consumer that doesn't really exist as much in the U and in you know, in Europe. I mean, when I say Europe, I mean, I want to say the rest of the world, but I mean, I haven't built companies in the rest of the world, so I don't want to speak, you know, talk nonsense. But I would also say the great thing about the US is the access to capital, the access to talent, this consumer that is in every state. So you have a huge market, like 330 million sized market, but everybody, regardless of the fact there's different states, there's a kind of monoculture and the laws are homogenous. And therefore it's not like in Europe, right? Where to get to 330 million people, you might have like 10 countries. That makes it really complex to build on, and investors are less excited potentially because of the, you know, that creates friction when you're trying to scale or get, you know, a consistent marketing message out there. So yeah, I think the US is by far, if you're a founder and you want to build something big, I mean, I don't think there's a substitute for the US. So the traffic only comes in one direction, right?
Yeah. What about mindset of people and like getting things done attitude? Apart from the market and the size of the potential customers pool, are there any kind of non-tangible aspects of that?
Yeah. So I tend to think that, like, New York is an example, and I've traveled around the US, but I mean, I live in New York. I've been here over 10 years now. So I think New York attracts a certain type of personality. You know, it's kind of, you know, when I came to New York, it was quite party hard and, you know, money driven. And it's like everybody I met was super ambitious and building something. And there's like a can do, that I think just attracts a certain type of person. So by definition, you end up with, you know, it's easier to find kind of similar minded co-founders and early teammates and investors. And again, just the whole culture kind of screams at, you know, everything can be improved. There's opportunity everywhere. So yeah, I think that's definitely true. People are keen to make a mark.
Okay. All right. Before we dive into the juicy stuff, just want to do some quick questions from each of your previous endeavors. So from each of those previous, I'll just repeat myself. Why not? From each of your previous endeavors, why can you give us one key lesson you've taken with you? And if anything is like stands out, or we have some further questioning, then I'll try and help you elaborate on that. So, as a carpenter.
I would say, like, you know, the parable measure of twice, cut once, but it taught me how to think about risk, because it's easy with software to make a mistake and all you've lost is your time. When you're the solo finished carpenter on site and you mess up some trim work, that stands out and it's not easily reversible. So it helped me think more about risk. Frameworks for thinking about risk.
Okay, yeah, makes sense. Okay, general contractor.
GC, yeah. Slow down to go faster. I think you're building really a lot of interconnected pieces there, and it's easy to get too far ahead on something, and then again, it's hard to undo mistakes when you're a GC. I think slowing down generally, and knowing, like, is something a one-way door, a two-way door? In other words, can you come back from it? Like, again, I think being a GC teaches you how to think about decision-making frameworks, risk frameworks. I think everyone thinks as an entrepreneur, you're just trying to take on big risk, but actually I think it's the opposite. It's mitigating risk and de-risking. So again, I think being a GC helped me there a lot.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Let's go for the final one. Board member.
Impulse control. I don't know if it's the same for investors, but if you're a founder and you sit on a board of another company, you're biting your tongue a lot. In fact, you're putting your hands in your pocket a lot because you kind of want to instinctively jump in and solve the problem. I mean, that's my instinct is always to try and fix and build something. So if I'm not the CEO, being able to stand back and advise and do so in a way that is, you know, almost Socratic versus, you know, dictatorial or, yeah. So I think impulse control, like, is the takeaway.
Good point. Okay, let's go.
Yeah, so Fraser, so Skillet. So on your website, you say construction staffing revolutionized. What does it mean? How does this construction staffing look like in a traditional way? And what do you propose?
Yeah, so, you know, so fundamentally, Skillet is building really the world's first data-driven craft recruitment or skilled worker recruitment platform, right, for the construction industry. The problem is, and this, I mean, I've experienced this personally as being a GC, is that I think fundamentally the world has kind of ignored the needs of skilled workers to such an extent that there's really no digitization of the characteristics that define their abilities, their pay aspirations, their skills, previous employment, et cetera. So they're fundamentally hard to find. It makes sourcing extremely difficult. It's still a very labor intensive, mostly manual process to hire as a result of that. Because if you don't have any good data on a worker, if you don't have a kind of rich 360 degree profile on a worker, like we take for granted with other platforms or LinkedIn for knowledge workers, if you don't have that, then you're trying to reach, it's hard to source, hard to reach. When you do, you're often pulling information for the first time manually. So that kind of like downstream process is really painful. Lots of siloed information, lots of friction, lots of dead weight loss. And it's very hard to then improve the downstream performance, right? Like, have you made the right hire? How do you know? There's no easy way to assess skills, for example. Lots of performative risk in asking, you know, say a carpenter to come to site and, you know, do some construction work without being an employee. So it's just fraught with friction. And I think the insight that we have at Skillet is that if you can digitize and gather data from workers that helps them build this kind of profile to rule them all, then the opportunity for them to be discovered is greatly increased. And therefore, you know, you can start to actually build out ways to make them more discoverable and find, you know, have the best employers come to them, make that process of connecting super fast, super efficient, much smarter. And then, of course, you can improve the downstream as well. You can improve eventually the training. You can improve the workforce development efforts, the retention, and so on and so forth. So, you know, yeah, I mean, that's the kind of, you know, insight behind the company.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so does it mean that it's going to be kind of LinkedIn for not knowledge people, that if I can put it this way? sorry guys, LinkedIn has been with us
just blame it, he's Polish, he's
LinkedIn has been with us probably around, I don't know, 12 maybe 15 years, I think. So no one has ever tried to do something like LinkedIn for workforce in the past. Have you studied that?
So I would say there has been attempts companies have tried this. Startups have come and gone that have tried to solve this, but I think they may have tried to replicate the LinkedIn playbook in order to achieve the same kind of equifinality, like the same outcome. But the reality is the demographics are very different, right? Like the technology of LinkedIn is actually potentially very valuable to the rest of the world. But unfortunately, if you're deskless and you don't perceive yourself as part of the kind of white collar workforce, then you don't feel like you belong in that community. So you might come for the tool, but you probably won't stay for the network because it's not a value to you. So I actually think we have a larger total addressable market, because what we're building for is fundamentally the deskless worker, starting with the construction worker for whom their smartphone is their office, right? Their hands are a premium. Might be cold out, right? Might have gloves on, might have a tool in your hand, might be driving. But yet you still need to be able to respond to an opportunity or, you know, seek an opportunity. So there's a different kind of, you know, like event horizon of thinking that needs to happen for the deskless worker and the construction worker. And you hear this a lot, you know, that demographic, they don't use technology. They all use Netflix. They all use Facebook. They all use Instagram. They're all like, it's just that nobody's designed the technology worker first for to meet their unique design experience requirements, right? So yeah, we've kind of intentionally gone down the path of building a professional network, not a social network. I've seen that attempted before, the social network angle, and it's not panned out very well. You know.
Yeah. That was going to actually be one of my questions, and you sort of half answered it, Fraser, was people's resilience in construction. You probably know how it is. And when you try and adopt new technology, people are like, you know, this is quite a negative attitude, although it is changing, obviously. Do you get that kind of experience with the people that are using your platform? Like, are they quite hard to convince that this is the solution?
Well, so on the worker side, no, because it's fairly straightforward and intuitive. You're signing up, you're providing your skills, your background information, so on and so forth. It's clear that this profile is clearly built for you to display your skills and your pay aspirations and even who you are personally in such a way that it's clearly going to be advantageous to anybody trying to hire you and give you an advantage there. On the employer side, I think one of the things in construction, and this might be true of other industries, but it's certainly true in construction. I think a lot of startups, if they're founded by folk that are not from the industry, there's often a lack of appreciation for how much effort a user is willing to put in order to get value from your product and how quick the time to value needs to be. So with Skillet, it's web-based, there's no download, there's no complex IT integration processes. You're essentially logging in and you're putting in some, you know, your location and, you know, we have advanced filters, but ultimately you're putting in the role that you're hiring for. And then you can instantly see all of the workers that have been already acquired, fully digitized, and have these data-rich profiles in front of you, and you can filter by all the necessary, you know, the prioritized criteria that you have. And then when you connect with a worker, we're building the technology to make it so that the worker is actually able to respond, regardless of, you know, the kind of format, if you will, like the, is it by phone, is it by text? What's their preference? So again, it's worker first, so you end up with a better connection rate. So it's very intuitive to go from kind of, you know, signing up, doing a simple search, seeing these data-rich profiles, connecting and getting a response from a qualified worker and hitting that kind of like aha moment with really very little investment. So we haven't really seen that kind of that friction. We're solving a real pain point. 90% of construction companies are struggling to hire skilled labor, and no one's digitized the worker previously. Yeah. No one's built the kind of the platform to help them connect easily. So.
Yeah, you mentioned an interesting point about the time to value. Do you think that's like a make or break for someone building a product in construction?
Yeah, I think there's two things. There's kind of like time to value, like how quickly do I go from learning or on, you know, discovering onboarding to actually getting to this like highly differentiated moment of value where I realize, oh, wow, I can't get this anywhere else. This is totally for me. This is incredible. It's going to solve my problem. I think in what we're doing, we want that to be in minutes, but, you know, other solutions, obviously, they might take, you know, some implementation or solutions implementation, onboarding, so on and so forth. I think the other piece as well is if you're doing anything kind of like LLM or AI related, and it actually takes time for the data itself to come out the other end, like, you know, you have to go through a project cycle and you have to be doing, as a user of the product, you have to be doing things that are not in native to your natural workflow. Like maybe you're going in and filling in, you know, performance data retroactively. I think that's a huge friction point, I think, for a lot of, you know, a lot of users, right, on the employer side or on the customer side. So I think it's time to value, and I think it's the amount of investment that's required by, you know, how much patience and time and resources required to get the solution to actually work.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I just want to touch on what's the target market, large, small, medium contractors or any?
Yeah, our target market initially is the kind of mid-market, you know, kind of 10 million in revenue to kind of like 100 million. We focused very heavily and intently on Florida. You know, we're essentially building a network effect business, right? Marketplace. I think being, you have attention constraints and you have capital constraints. Regardless of how well capitalized you are, you need to assume that you have very narrow focus and very little capital and very little time. And so therefore, geographically focusing on a segment. So we focused on the mid-market customer with, you know, a handful of recruiters, typically founded after 1990. So we've got really into the concept of like the ideal customer profile and really hyper segmenting so that we can essentially, you know, delight the first early users of our product. And that's mostly across commercial. We mostly are hiring, our customers are mostly hiring for hard hat wearing trades and all mostly W-2 as well. So not so much 1099. We're focused on the full-time employee.
Okay. So what trend do you see in the market? Because I remember when I used to work for a general contractor, probably 7-8 years ago, all of them at that time were trying to not to employ people, but they tried to have subcontractors who will do the parts of the work. And I actually don't know what's the trend, but my feeling is that it has not gone the other way. But what do you see right now?
That it's gone the other way. So self-perform contracting, especially in the US, is forecasted to grow at least 100% in the next 5 years. So it's going to be doubling the number of craft workers that are employed in these companies, which is essentially like a net new worker, like a million net new workers. So today, about 23% of craft workers, skilled workers in construction, are self-employed. That's twice as many as any other industry. But of the kind of tens of thousands of workers that we've onboarded, 92% of them want full-time work with an employer that respects their craft, pays them fairly, gives them workforce development opportunities, right? Basically, they're looking for a home. And I think there's a few things at play here. Like when the economy is doing great and we, in the early days of the gig economy and the Uberization of stuff, you know, we were all kind of beating this drum of everyone wants to be a founder. Like, you know, it's like being an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. I mean, you got to call bullshit on that. If you're, you know, working early entry job into construction, 20, 30 bucks an hour, you're really wanting stability. And if you think about it from the employer side, if this labor crisis is the biggest risk to the industry. So if you see any of the CEOs at these mid-market, we also have enterprise customers, so, you know, 100 million revenue all the way up to $10 billion revenue. If you see, they often view themselves as like risk managers that build things. So the biggest risk they have is this labor shortage. And when you have a risk like that, which is the common denominator across your entire operation, the smart thing to do is to decide to pull it in-house, pull the control of that risk in-house, build a world-class recruiting operation. And arguably, we're in the right place at the right time here, because what better way to do that than to have a data-driven, you know, skilled recruiting platform that can actually both solve the sourcing and the hiring piece, but also give you the data that you need in order to become, you know, competitive and a better long-term, like, world-class employer of craft labor, because it's increasingly going to be critical to hire well and train and retain well. And so this gives GCs the power to better control safety, quality, schedule, budgets, culture, all of which are key to their commercial success by having full control over their labor force. So that is a trend that we are seeing for sure.
Sounds good.
That's interesting. Yeah. I want to move on to, I do have some more questions on that, but I really want to touch on your experience with raising funds, because you guys, I can't remember time frame, but it was around about 13 million, was it? 13 and a half mil?
Yeah.
So does this question make sense? Is why so much? Obviously, because your company was valued at a high valuation, but like, why do you need that amount of money to build what you're building, I guess? And secondly, how did you do it?
How did you raise them?
It's a good question. So why do we need that money? I view it as, I think when you're, if you're fortunate enough to be well capitalized as a startup, there's a tendency, I think, to think that that means you can spend a lot of money. But I tend to view it more as an insurance policy. It gives us runway to continue to improve on the core fundamental. Like, our goal right now is product market fit, building a product our customers love, building, like, learning, you know, learning how our customers think, learning how their businesses work, learning the key drivers of the business, learning how to control those dials and what forces govern those dials. And how do you take that and build it into a repeatable playbook and show that you've got a really kind of high growth, high scale product that has, I mean, at its core, I believe retention is probably the unspoken growth engine in startups, right? Like, a lot of focus on the top line and very little focus on, is that an efficient growth engine? Do you have the right engagement? Do you have the right retention? So that takes time. Like, you know, there's a reason no one's succeeded at doing this before. It's because it's devilishly difficult. This is a hard company to build. So we want to give ourselves as much runway as possible. The other side to that is, the upside here, we're arguably building a very large, very valuable company of consequence. So the upside on the other side is there, and I think that's enabled us to, you know, attract. Obviously, I'm very lucky to have a great team. I think we've got a solid kind of vision. The mission is personal. Our story is authentic, so therefore I think investors resonate with that and are excited to support the company on our mission. So to answer the question, or I don't know if I veered off a wee bit there.
Yeah, no, it was the second part of it, and it's a broad question, so answer it how you see fit, is how you done that. And I guess maybe the key sort of guiding star in the question is that obviously meeting the investors was a large part of that. So yeah, just how you went about the process, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, I'm a glutton for kind of like research, if you will, pain, like burning the calories, like being structured around actually figuring out who are the best investors by thesis, by stage, by partner, by have they invested in a competing idea? Is, you know, are they investors in network effect businesses? Are they so honing really in on targeting your like ideal investor profile? I don't know if we can coin that here, like an IIP. Like, I think as a founder, you should be figuring out who your ideal investor is, rather than just, you know, it's not a shotgun approach. That there's no time for that. Mm. So I think being really, really disciplined about understanding who your investors likely are. And then I think running a really kind of honest process with yourself. There's a lot of like, I mean, I've raised money a few times, so there's kind of tricks of the trade, I guess. You know, starting the process with everyone at the same time, helping an investor feel like there's only room for one investor, being honest with yourself about how well you're doing, getting to know's really quickly, like being kind of annoyingly persistent. Like, is it a yes or a no? Is that a yes or a no? Because when you tell me no, I move on and I add another investor to the top of my funnel. If I think it's a maybe, I might not. Like, you know what I mean? There's a lot of managing your own psychology to this process. That the preparation and the frankness actually helps you achieve and you know, corral everybody to the finish line. I picked based on I'm going to spend the next 10, 15, 20 years with this person. You know, it's like being married, but without the possibility of divorce. So,
and you only have a few months to decide.
Yeah. I think that's super important. Like, they might be a really prestigious firm, or they might, you know, that's great. And but again, if it reaches, if it meets your criteria for what you're looking for in an investor, but ultimately, can you imagine spending your time with this individual or this partner? Will they go to bat for you? Like, do they have immediate conviction? You know, I tend to get the impression that someone should immediately love what you're building and love you, love your story. And then they should be kind of ticking boxes to make sure that they're being diligent, right? They're rather than the other way around of being like skeptical and you having to convince them over time. So that's a signal I tend to look for and stay away from. Like, if you don't get it in the first pitch, you know, bye.
Fraser, is there anything that you would do differently when raising money? Or maybe you have any particular advice for entrepreneurs who would like to raise money for their startup?
I mean, it's tough because I think it depends on what stage you're at, right? Like, the earlier on you are, the more it's about you and your story. And the later on you are, the more it's about your company's traction and the key metrics that you're hitting and the you know, how inevitable is that to continue and grow into a venture sized, you know, return, if you will. So, but I mean, I would say some really good advice is, know who you're investing, like know why you're raising money, know who the right investors are for your business. Don't fool yourself, like be brutally honest with yourself and how well you're performing in the fundraise, and get your story straight. I really think story is the critical piece. Like, data is king and all that, and having a quantitative understanding of a business and showing the kind of like shoots and ladders to how you go from like where you are now to how you win and you know, dominate an industry or but the story, I think if you have a super compelling founding story and vision for why your company needs to exist, I think that's what that to me feels like the critical piece. Because
that hits the human emotions.
Have you ever read Sapiens Yuval Noah Harari. Mm-hmm. You know, he talks about this moment 70 odd thousand years ago where there's like, you know, multiple human species, and Homo sapien kind of leaps forward. And how there's this, I think he calls it a cognitive revolution. And it's this idea that we just went from looking at a cow thinking that's a cow to a DNA mutation that in one or two or three generations, people were thinking, I wonder what that cow's up to tomorrow. Like, I wonder, does that cow think? And you get in, like, our ability to imagine, and the fodder for that is story. And so I think it's really fundamental to be able to tell a story that not just like a compelling story, but one that actually involves others and gets them excited about supporting you in your mission and becomes their story. Like when your founding team are joining you, this becomes their story. This is their reason for jumping out of bed in the morning and running hard at something, because they believe in the mission. And I think that's probably the most important piece of advice, is get a story really tight and compelling.
So stories were the reason that humans managed to evolve from other species. The reason humans like were able to evolve from the other creatures was because of our ability to tell stories. And Fraser was saying that get your story straight. So to raise money, you need to tell a great story. So stories made us survive and evolve. And now people are investing in stories. Connect the dots how you will.
Yeah, and it's the mechanism by which we've been able to scale things and operate at scale versus just, you know, individuals and small little groups of people. Like, you know, he goes into the whole idea of essentially a public company is a story, a country is a story. These are structures at scale which you know, narrative kind of is the connective tissue. So yeah, it's a good book. But anyway. Storytelling. Yeah, I think that's
my... Fraser, you mentioned a few times risk mitigation at the early stage of an interview and later as well. So I just wanted to, because it's so visible when you explain things, like what is your framework for risk mitigation in life or in business? Because I feel there is something to it. When you explained like cutting as a piece of furniture as a carpenter, you mentioned risk mitigation, insurance policy. When you grow a startup, also risk mitigation. So how do you think about mitigation of risks in life and business?
So I think I try and seek out people that have done something similar before or have been there before. I'm kind of like information hungry. I like to read up a lot on things and talk to folk that have done things before. And then I kind of like scenario play. I'm certainly on the business side. I mean, thank God for Excel, right? Like spreadsheets, the ability to just model something out and see it kind of, do the numbers make sense? Like if the numbers don't make sense, I tend to, that's where I need to take action. So, but I don't know. I have a few things. Like, I guess I ask myself if it's myself and my team, right? Is there like a task relevant maturity here? Like does somebody in my team actually understand how to do something better than I do? And if so, is it something that blows up the business, or is it something that like we recover from? Is it like a week of cash flow? Is it like a week of burn, or is it like a month of burn? You know, if it's a week of burn and they're an expert, I'm like, I full on like abdicate, like go do it. You know better than I do. If it's something that I'm like, yeah, you've done this before, but that's an expensive mistake. If we get that wrong, I trust you, but like, let me handhold, let me shadow with you, let me work with you. If it's something that I don't feel, then I will take it on and run with it. And it will be mine to, you know, to make sure it's done right. So just, you know, thinking in terms of like, what's the worst that can happen as well, just some like regression analysis of like, what is the worst thing that can happen here? And what's the best thing that can happen? So I don't have like a framework per se. I just have like a bunch of tools that I've acquired throughout the years to know the edges of something. And often you're operating with incomplete information, and it comes down to courage. I actually think the job of a founder is to be courageous, not smart. Well, let me rephrase that. this saying, you shouldn't be the smartest person in the room. Have you ever thought about why we call it artificial intelligence, not artificial smarts? Because intelligence means...
Go on.
Intelligence is like IQ, right? It's like learned. Raw processing power, logic, okay. Memory. Smarts is like, how does the world really work? How do people think?
Guts.
How do they, right? Uh-huh. I actually think as a founder, I'll say this, it's controversial. You should be the smartest person in the room. You don't want to be the most intelligent, but you should be the smartest. And I think part of that smarts is knowing this is really risky and we don't actually understand enough, but we need to proceed and therefore have the courage to actually move forward. I think that becomes a more and more important piece of the job as the companies, as you scale, as you build a growing company.
Mm-hmm. Brilliant. Interesting, yeah. Well, I just want to ask one last thing on the VC side of things is allocating resource when you receive capital. So do you have any kind of someone's like, here's a fat check. It's like, okay, what the hell do I do with this? Like, what's your process behind that?
Well, to be clear, I've never raised more money than we need. I've always had a plan to achieve the next, the next milestone and aim to get there with that capital. So the answer is pretty simple. It's deployed to plan. That plan being, it might have a half-life of 3 months, and then you're kind of reiterating on it. But I'm consistently trying to execute to plan. So,
So it's not like you raise money and then what to do with it.
No. I think very few founders can just go and raise a ton of money and then get the luxury of figuring out what they're going to do with it next. That's part and parcel of justification for the investment, right?
How would that work? Like you say to the investors that I probably need around, I'm just saying, $6 million. And we think that for this $6 million we'll be able to X, Y, Z. And what do they say? How do they react? What's their due diligence on that? How did it look like in your case?
Well, I think you should know. You should know your forward-looking plan inside out, in the sense that I mentioned shoots and ladders. I think it's a good analogy to go from here's where we are right now. We have I'm not skillet per se, just, theoretically speaking, we have one, mm-hmm. We've spoken to 20 customers or 50 customers. We've got a value hypothesis. We think this is their, this is the fundamental pain point they're struggling with. This is how we would address it. This is the size of the market. This is how, this is the team I've put together, whatever. Yeah. Yeah. And then you're going to say, I think these are the exact steps we need to take in order to avoid the shoots that come with this. And here's the ladders we can take to get essentially to the winning point, which is the next milestone. Here's exactly how I'm going to do it. And you should be able to have that thinking attacked from every angle and stress tested in every conceivable way, qualitatively, quantitatively. And they're going to do that via customer, interviews, hopefully at the end of your process, not at the beginning. I think it's about being able to communicate clearly where you're at, what your goals are, why those are the goals, and how what you're about to do next gets you to the next milestone that is valuable to the company's kind of progress. I don't see an alternative.
Okay, brilliant.
Okay, I think I'll end with one last question on. What do you think is the number one skill someone needs as a CEO?
The number one skill.
risk mitigation.
Maybe, but you, like, there's things that you have to own that no one else can do. So you have to be able to define the strategy, the goals. You need to be able to define the culture, right? The people, the vision. Again, I think a lot of that comes down to storytelling. I really think you own the story. It might not, you may own it. You may not always be the one responsible for improving it. There's other people around you that can help to, you know, like a bird building a nest kind of thing, right? Twig at a time, you're building this narrative, but you have to own that and be able to communicate it really effectively. And again, I really think that's an important skill, because I've had kind of interactions with founders who disagree with that. And they're like, no, the number one job is like getting traction. The number one job is, you know, and it's like, yeah, but those are all essential. But if you can't tell a story, then no investors backing you, no teammates, or you're not going to pull really talented people away from what they're working on. And customers are not going to buy from you. So like, it kind of feels to me like that's sales. If I was to sum up in one word, that was a bit of a loquacious answer. I would say sales.
Yeah.
The ability to sell.
No, good. Yeah, I like it.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Do you think these features can be like taught, or do you kind of either born with it and you evolve and the show express these features that you can sell things to other people, or it's kind of like you can?
Yeah, I think so.
Which one?
I think you can learn, because there's definitely skills attached to being good in sales, understanding your, mm-hmm. you know, understanding who you're talking to and getting to the root of their problem and just the whole process of selling. But I mean, you got to be really passionate about what you're building. Like you have to be, I think you have to love the problem you're solving, not the solution, the problem.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
So if you love the problem, you're just going to keep figuring out ways to understand it more and more, and then you get better and better at actually like selling solutions to that problem.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, sadly, we've run out of time, but I think that was a good way to end where we got to. Can you tell us where people can find out more about you and even Skillet?
Yeah, skillet.com is our website. We're also obviously on LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, but skillet.com. If you're obviously an employer hiring for craft labor, or you're a skilled worker looking for, you know, your next great opportunity, then skillet.com.
Excellent. Okay, brilliant. Thanks, Fraser.
Thank you.
Thanks.